What does Alexander the Great have to do with the Bible you read? We'll find out as Dr. R.C. Sproul explores the gap between the Old Testament and New Testament. Stay tuned. Renewing Your Mind, Weekend Edition, is next. Welcome to this weekend edition of Renewing Your Mind with founder and president of the Ligonier Academy of Biblical and Theological Studies, Dr. R.C. Sproul. The period between the Old Testament and the New Testament is one of the most overlooked eras of biblical history. During that era, Aristotle developed his system of thought and logic that are still with us today. But it was Aristotle's most famous student who laid the groundwork for the New Testament to be written. Even the Old Testament translation used in Jesus' day can be attributed to this pagan conqueror. Today on Renewing Your Mind, Weekend Edition, we're beginning the second part of Dr. Sproul's survey of the Bible, entitled Dust to Glory. Before we go straight into the New Testament, we'll learn about the important political and religious changes that took place both in Israel and abroad as they relate to the overall drama of redemption. Let's now join R.C. with more about this intriguing time of biblical history.
We come now to the beginning of the second segment of our study of the survey of the Scriptures from dust to glory. And now we are about to begin our exploration of the major themes of the New Testament. The New Testament period opens with the announcement in the Gospels of the Pleroma, which concept is translated by the words fullness of time. There's a keen sense in the New Testament that what takes place in this brief period of time in which our Lord was on this earth and active in His ministry, that this period of history was what history was created for in the first place. That from all eternity, God created a plan of redemption. And now that plan of redemption comes to its main fruition in the history of redemption in the period of the New Testament. So it's not as if things just happened suddenly coming down from the sky, but there was a long period of preparation throughout the whole Old Testament where God was preparing the world for the coming of His Son in the Incarnation. Now, the Old Testament closes about 400 years before the New Testament begins. And those 400 years, of course, about which the Old Testament is silent, are not insignificant in terms of the history of the world and the time of preparation for this fullness, this moment of pregnancy when the Incarnation takes place. That 400-year period, as I say, is called the Intertestamental Period. In 445, the walls of Jerusalem were finished in their rebuilding process under the leadership of Nehemiah. And at this time in redemptive history, Israel was now a small nation struggling for survival in the ancient Mideast. And as I've said repeatedly, Palestine sort of functioned as a geopolitical football among the major powers of that day that were vying with each other for world domination. At the end of the Old Testament, we see that period of domination in the world by the Medo-Persian Empire. And the Persian Empire lasted until towards the end of the 4th century B.C. to the year 331, when Persia was conquered by Alexander the Great. And of course, the story of Alexander is one of the most interesting and fascinating stories of all of world history, because at the time that he put the finishing touches on his conquest of the Persian Empire, he was 24 years old. And Alexander, of course, was the son of Philip of Macedon. Philip was the king of Macedonia. And Alexander had been a student of the philosopher Aristotle. And that's an interesting process in and of itself, because we go back into the history of ancient Greece and we see three giants, three titans who would influence Western civilization from that point after, who succeeded one another in direct succession. First, of course, is Socrates. And Socrates' main pupil was Plato, who established his academy in Athens. And then Plato had a star pupil whose name was Aristotle, and he started his school called the Lyceum. And then Aristotle's most famous pupil was Alexander. Now, Alexander, of course, is not known for being a philosopher. He's known for being a military genius and a world conqueror. And we ask, how in the world does that fit in with his studies under the tutelage of Aristotle? Well, Aristotle, of all of the great thinkers of the ancient world, had a consuming passion for unity. He wanted to come up with a scientific system and a philosophical system that would integrate all the fields of knowledge in a coherent system. And his passion for unity caused him to differ sharply at certain points with his own teacher, Plato. But he communicated this passion for unity, scientifically and philosophically, to his star pupil, Alexander. For example, when Alexander began his military conquest of the ancient world, he took with him on his mission the largest entourage of scientists ever assembled up to that point in history for a scientific expedition. It's been said that the cost of supporting this scientific expedition of Alexander's was not surpassed until the American space program in our own day. So Alexander didn't just have his soldiers marching with him, but he had all these scientists whose task it was to collect samples of flora and fauna from all of these zones and areas of geography that the army visited, so that they could be brought back and be part of the systematic analysis of knowledge of Alexander's teacher, Aristotle. Not only that, but Alexander had a vision of unifying the ancient world culturally. And so he became the original author of a process that became very important to biblical history, which was the process called Hellenization, which was the Greekifying of the ancient world. Alexander wanted to have all of the people in that area speak the same language, have the same philosophy, have the same cultural mores, and so on. So that was all part of his agenda for conquest, and ultimately is the reason why the New Testament was written not in Hebrew or in Aramaic, but in the Greek tongue. Well, as I said, in 331, Alexander conquered the Persians. But in 327, he died in Babylon as he was about to vanquish the Babylonian Empire. And upon his death, his kingdom was divided among his generals. In fact, there were eight surviving generals that engaged in a brutal power struggle to see who would reign supreme and inherit the kingdoms established by Alexander. But it ended up ultimately being divided among two different groups. The Ptolemies, and you may have heard of that name, as the Ptolemaic system of the universe was that influenced by Aristotle's physics and astronomy, and that reigned supreme until the Copernican Revolution in the modern period. The Ptolemies and the Seleucids. Now, initially, Palestine was controlled by the Ptolemaic dynasty that controlled Egypt as well. The Seleucids ruled over Syria and other portions of the world at that time. Now, in the year 320, Palestine was annexed by Ptolemy I of Egypt. So this surviving general of Alexander, Ptolemy I, took control of Palestine as part of his dominion that included Egypt. And that lasted for a couple of decades until the year 198 BC. In 198, Antiochus, who was Antiochus III, wrested control of Palestine and brought it over now to the dominion of the Seleucids and the Syrian Empire. So this is what was going on here, as the control of Palestine was shifting and changing between the successors of the kingdom of Alexander the Great. Now, the significance of this movement in 198, whereby Antiochus III takes control of Palestine, is that Antiochus III had, if anything, a more ardent passion for Hellenization than even Alexander had originally. And as a result of this, he imposed by force a process of Hellenization upon the Jewish people. Now, his attempt to make Greeks out of the Jews in Palestine was fiercely resisted by a small group of Orthodox, pious, conservative Jews who did everything in their power to preserve the ancient culture of Judaism, and they were called the Hasidians, or the pious ones. And we still hear of Hasidic Judaism even in this day. It's also significant that during the intertestamental period, as the Jewish culture was becoming eclipsed by the influence of Greek culture, that other groups began to emerge who sought to maintain the purity of their own ancient traditions. And one of the most important of these groups was the group called the Pharisees, and we meet frequently in the New Testament. In a sense, the Pharisees were the original Puritans of the church. They were called the separated ones, whose commitment was to be zealous for the ancient covenant of the Jewish nation, and to be obedient to every aspect of the Old Testament law. Now, by the time we meet the Pharisees in the New Testament, they have degenerated into a self-righteous, externalistic, hypocritical group of people who were deeply opposed to Jesus and to his mission. But originally, they were godly men who were devoted towards reformation, towards restoring the historic faith of the people of Israel. Now, one of the most important moments that transpired in the intertestamental period took place in the year 175 BC. When another Antiochus rose to power. And his name was Antiochus Epiphanes. Antiochus Epiphanes. Now, that name may be familiar to you for one or more reasons. You've certainly heard the word Epiphany. And we even have a celebration in the church year that honors the day of Epiphany. And Epiphany, the word, means manifestation. Antiochus Epiphanes was called by this name because he was considered to be the manifest God. He was Antiochus, the manifest God. And some scholars came to the conclusion that he was demented because of the bizarre nature of his behavior. Antiochus Epiphanes is related to biblical prophecy of the coming of the abomination of desolation that had been predicted in the Old Testament scriptures. He came to power and implemented a radically anti-Jewish program in the nation and was called by pious Jews, instead of Antiochus Epiphanes, that is, Antiochus the manifest God, he was called Antiochus Epimenes, Epimenes, which means Antiochus the insane. And the reason for this negative handle that was associated with him is because He was, as it were, kind of the Hitler of the second century B.C. Under Antiochus Epiphanes, the observance of the Sabbath day, the practice of circumcision as a religious rite, and the possession of Hebrew scriptures. These three things, observance of the Sabbath day, the act of circumcision, and even owning or possessing any copy or portion of the Old Testament scriptures, all of these things were considered by Antiochus Epiphanes capital crimes. So that if a Jew observed the Sabbath, he could be put to death under the reign of this man who is associated with the abomination of desolation, which reached its climax in the year 167, when after abolishing all forms of Jewish worship, the ultimate sacrilege was committed when Antiochus had a pig sacrificed on the sacred altar in the temple. And this was more than the people of Israel could bear. And his regime was so harsh and the persecution so cruel and so extensive that a spirit of revolt began to brew among the Jewish people. And in the year 164 B.C., we have what has been called in history the Maccabean Revolt. The Maccabean Revolt came to pass when a man, a Jewish believer by the name of Mattathias, who had five sons, rose up in protest against the policies of Antiochus and sought to fight a rear guard guerrilla warfare type of insurrection against the Antiochian invaders. Well, in the beginning of this period, very shortly after the revolt broke out, Mattathias died. And so the leadership of the revolt fell to his third oldest son, whose name was Judas. And he received the name Judas Maccabeus, which means Judas the Hammerer. And he became a national hero and remains a national hero in Jewish tradition because of his daring and bold raids and forays against the invaders. And he was able to win certain concessions from the rulers in the year 164, which included the religious freedom being restored to the Jewish people and the temple being opened once again for the celebration of Jewish worship. And so in that year, the Jewish temple was rededicated, and a great feast and celebration ensued, which is celebrated to this very day. The reopening and rededication of the temple took place in the month of December and is celebrated to this day under the feast of Hanukkah. We're all familiar with the Jewish celebration of Hanukkah, which is a celebration of the victory of Judas Maccabeus in this period of revolt. In 142, the Jews under the Maccabees were able to gain their full freedom from foreign domination. And their liberation and freedom lasted from the year 142 until the year 63 BC, when Palestine was once again conquered. But this time, the conquerors were the Romans. And the general who was responsible for the conquest of Palestine in the year 63 BC is a man with whom we're somewhat familiar because of our awareness of Shakespeare's play, Julius Caesar, and our history books that tell us of the first great triumvirate that included in its members the general whose name was Pompey. And Pompey, you know, became associated with Julius Caesar, and there was all kinds of intrigue later on, and we remember in the story that Shakespeare gives us of the assassination of Julius Caesar, that when Brutus stabbed Caesar, and Caesar's last words were what? Et tu, Brute, then fall Caesar. And then the climactic moment in this scene of the play, Julius Caesar falls dead there on the floor of the Senate, and he falls dead at the foot of the bust of Pompey. Well, it's this man, Pompey, who was responsible for the Roman conquest of the Jewish nation in the year 63. Now, 23 years later, in 40 BC, there was a new moment that took place when, under the Roman domination, an Idumean chieftain was appointed, more or less as a local vassal, by the Roman authorities to be a local king over the Jews. And this man's name was Herod the Great. And Herod the Great really founded a dynasty. He's the one who rebuilt the massive structure called the Herodian Temple, and certainly would be famous in world history, even if he didn't figure prominently in the New Testament, for the extraordinary building projects that he established during his reign. But he was also known for his cruelty and for his viciousness as a puppet king of Rome. He was installed largely by the influence of two Romans, whose names were Octavius and Mark Antony. Mark Antony of Antony and Cleopatra fame. And Octavius, who becomes Caesar Augustus, who is mentioned specifically in the New Testament. But it is significant that when the New Testament opens, the people of Israel are now groaning under foreign rule once again with the power of Rome and the power of Rome standing behind their puppet king, who is conceived by the Jewish people to be a traitor to their national interests. That's the drama, that's the setting in which the New Testament opens.
You're listening to Renewing Your Mind, Weekend Edition with Dr. R.C. Sproul, reminding us that even though God was silent during the intertestamental period, His providential hand was still preparing for the coming of the Messiah. Today's message, The Intertestamental Period, is part of a study series by Dr. Sproul entitled Dust to Glory. Unlike the Old Testament, the New Testament was written in less than a century. 27 books teaching us about the birth, life, death, resurrection, reign, and return of Jesus Christ. Although smaller than the Old Testament, it's just as complex with its various forms of literature, such as the four Gospels, numerous epistles, and the mysterious apocryphal book of Revelation. How can the church today benefit from ancient letters written to churches in the first century? Why do we have four Gospels instead of one? To make sense of the many themes in Scripture and how they all culminate in the person and work of Christ, Dr. Sproul has put together a series entitled Dust to Glory. Today, we're making a very special offer. We're offering the entire Dust to Glory New Testament collection on audio CDs for your donation of any amount. This series makes an excellent resource for personal or group study. To get your copy of Dust to Glory New Testament, call now to reserve your copy. The number is 1-800-435-4343. Again, that's 800-435-4343. Or visit rymoffer.com. That's RYM as in Renewing Your Mind, and the word offer.com. That web address is for this week's special offer only. Often, when people read the Bible, they focus on particular books and their favorite Bible verses without understanding the major themes in redemptive history. In this overview series, Dr. Sproul explores the major themes, events, and people of redemptive history, providing a panorama of biblical truth and a starting point to help you understand the content of the Bible. Again, the entire Dust to Glory New Testament CD collection is available for your donation of any amount. Call now to reserve your copy of the Dust to Glory Old Testament series. 1-800-435-4343. Again, that's 800-435-4343. Or visit rymoffer.com. That's RYM as in renewing your mind, and the word offer.com. That web address is for this week's special offer only. That'll bring a close to this weekend edition of Renewing Your Mind. Thanks for joining us. Be sure to join us again next weekend as we continue our journey through the New Testament with Dr. Sproul. Until then, join us on Facebook.com/Ligonier. Have a great weekend and Lord's Day. You're listening to Renewing Your Mind, Weekend Edition, the listener-supported radio outreach of Ligonier Ministries in Orlando, Florida.